You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In this episode, I speak with Marcos.
My name is Marcos Moldes. I'm a senior qualitative UX researcher at Pinterest. Prior to that, I was a resident ethnographer for a small design research firm called Idea Couture. And prior to that, I was in academic, career changed into the industry. Currently, I am the research lead for an area of the product called Content and Curators. So really looking at the user needs and pain points that people who upload original content onto Pinterest face and how we can address those.
Marcos will be talking about research participant panels. So you are a former academic, so you have your PhD. I'm always curious about the PhD to UX researcher pipeline. So how did you transition out of your PhD?
So I moved to London, the UK. I finished my PhD. I'm Canadian. I was living in Vancouver, wrapping up my PhD. For personal reasons, I moved to the UK and I was like, what? I don't know what I'm going to do now. And I was on the job market and, trying to apply for postdoctoral positions. And it just so happened that an applied research opportunity opened up and I was like, this is a job. This is cool. So ended up going that route. And then, so I was, a design researcher for 2 years. And then I knew I really wanted to move very specifically in-house and onto a digital product. So just started applying and basically applied until I found an opportunity that really made sense for me. And thankfully it worked out. And so here I am almost 4 years later.
And in the 4 years you've been doing research, I'm sure that you've done a lot of recruitment. And mm-hmm. I always think that recruitment is one of the hardest parts of being a researcher. It's hard getting people to come and talk to you. But if you are doing recruitment, panels can make that a little bit easier. And you have had a lot of experience, or you've had some experience with research panels. How would you define a research panel?
A couple of different ways. First, a shout out to anyone who handles recruitment, like research ops. You people are angels, far more patient than me. you have your kind of typical, pool of participant research panels that you can dip into. I'm thinking of the large the D-Scouts, the user testings, the user interviews of the world where, do you have a pulse and meet these very basic criteria? Great. Amazing. And those are easy enough to use. Where I think a panel gets really interesting and becomes very, very useful from a research perspective is when you are working on a niche population or a population that just has that needs to meet a lot of characteristics. When we were recruiting content creators, I've been working on content creators for 3 years. And when I started, my recruits would take a long time because one, I would need to train a recruiting firm or a recruiter, who these people were. And then anytime I switched recruiters or tried a different vendor, it was a re-onboarding process all over again. And it was just getting really tiresome and it was taking weeks to just recruit creators. And I was like, I need a way to just have a pool that's big enough that I'm not getting sample bias and chatting with the same 6 creators over and over and over again, but also just a pool that I can draw on for those quick studies where it's like, I just need some usability feedback. I just want to do an empathy hour and get people in just to talk to the population we're building a product for. So I think of a research panel as a tool, almost like sitting on ready, waiting for me to access these participants who aren't as easy to find as your average, I just need someone who uses a mobile phone and buys things online.
And where do you find people for the research panel? I know I've tried to do panels in the past and they were hard to do. And the hardest part was finding people who were very niche, like you said. When you're using a panel, it's usually because you're trying to reach a super targeted population. And by virtue of them being very targeted, they're hard to reach. So where do you find people for the panels?
Sure. We partnered with a recruiter with a research firm that does recruitment, and gave them like a very specific list of criteria. They ran like Instagram. So because we were doing creators, influencers, bloggers, they ran like Instagram ads, Facebook ads, and we then worked pr fairly side by side in terms of like vetting these people. Like, okay, they would send me a grid and I would go through and like yes to this one, no to this one for XYZ reasons. And we tried to make sure that the criteria that we set up for the panel in terms of, okay, we want 300 creators. I want 50 that look like this. I want 100 that look like this. We always kept that top of mind to make sure that we were getting sort of as diverse a recruit as possible, but also, meeting the needs of like who we thought we were going to need to talk to for the year. It was a pretty labor-intensive thing to set up. We also worked, Pinterest has relationships with creators around the world through our global content and creators team. So, we put the word out to them of like, hey, we're recruiting creators to be part of this like research pool. I think we said like research panel. If you're interested in participating, here's the link to sign up. So it was a mix of sort of like targeted and solicited folks of creators that we had a pre-existing relationship with, and also then trying to make sure we got creators who had never spoken to anyone at Pinterest before, so that we could capture both sides of that.
How are people who are on research panels different than research participants who are not on panels? Is it always because the panelists are more targeted? Is that always the case?
In my experience with like my panel, I didn't see much of a difference between participants who were on the panel and part and other creators who, for other projects I recruited outside of the panel or had, I didn't find a really big difference, in part because like the people we were going after were so niche that like the behavior I was like looking for, or the actions they were taking that I was looking for, just required a certain amount of selection. I think if I'm understanding correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the question behind the question is like, are you concerned about selection bias in a panel versus like a Gen Pop? That's always a concern, and that was something that, so we would try to make sure that if someone participated in one study, there was like a cool off period before they could participate again. And if there was anyone who was a, if there was any participant that felt a bit too like eager to please, we would sort of like flag that in, in our notes. So there's always bias mitigation and it's always a concern. I don't know though, like I remember once using a panel, like a just Gen Pop recruitment panel. I'm not going to say the name. And that participant boasted about how they had funded their entire Christmas last year through research studies that they had done. So I don't, I don't, I think like the minute you're using a tool to recruit someone, like people have already self-selected in, right? So I'm not sure if my concern around selection bias with the like very curated panel that we had created was any more or any less than anytime I dip into a large panel vendor.
Yeah, like that selection bias, like you said, it's inherent, especially because these people opted in. That's true.
Totally.
And I know one of the biggest issues I had, you mentioned that you spoke to someone in the past who mentioned that they funded their Christmas with the incentives they got from doing research.
Yeah.
How do you vet panel participants? Because that's a big issue for me too, because you have people who you have your screeners, but you always have someone who just kind of seeps through, right? There's always that one,
Always.
right? So how do you vet, right? Always that one. How do you vet these panel participants?
Oh my God, I felt like I was getting like CIA level creepy, not really, but I was lucky in that the folks we were recruiting were content creators. So these are people who, by virtue of their job, it was very easy to find their TikTok, their Instagram, their blog, because that's their bread and butter, that's their trade. So we were able to look at the grid and see like what they had record what they had said. Here's the content I create, here's where I create, here's how often I create, here's the size of my audience. and just sort of do a quick vet of like, yeah, this feels right. Like this person is a food blogger, with a sort of like 100,000 followers on Instagram or whatever. But I think that's very unique to the population that we were working with, right? Like these are people who are by virtue of the job very public and have very and share a lot. So it made vetting very easy. If I were to think about like how would I apply this to another panel, I think that's where it gets really hard. And in a sense, you always just have to recognize that like any panel recruitment will have your, I call them the first pancake, right? That pancake participant that you're like, you're not quite right. And so in a sense, you kind of have to, I would argue, or if I was going to tell someone, I was like, you have to acknowledge that there's going to be a percentage of that in every study. And so factor for that. And then I think it a lot comes down to, and I'm not the world's greatest screener writer, is like get detailed, ask questions in a couple of different ways. You have to be a little bit meticulous in the way you recruit, which can be it can be tough. And then sometimes if you're recruiting for something really difficult, you also kind of have to take what you can get, right? And sort of your job as a researcher is to then extrapolate and try to sift through like what that could look like. So if I wanted to chat with like neurosurgeons who perform, surgery on cancer patients, right? Like there are recruits that are that specific. You kind of have to, okay, like what's a, am I gonna get the most prestigious surgeon in the country? Probably not. Like they're busy. So will I need to, kind of factor for that in my research design? Probably.
Yeah, and there's definitely a huge degree of giving yourself grace as a researcher, just accounting for that, like you said. And I know for me, I usually like to recruit more people than what I probably need. If I want to speak to
Totally.
10, I'll recruit 12, assuming that those two will probably be a little bit shaky in a bunch. So I just account for that. So yeah, I think that researchers listening to this are probably nodding their heads in agreement. Yeah, vetting is really hard. And I like what you said about not being a great screener, because writing screeners is very hard. Sometimes it may seem like, oh yes, the screener is great, and then you actually run the screener, and then the people that you get are not quality. They're not matching what you wanted, and so you have to go back and do a second version and a third version. And it's not always easy. There's a lot of trial and error with screener development as well.
I think it's such a like it's such an art and science because you don't the screener needs to be not too long, but also long enough that like you're able to sort of tease out like who you're trying to actually talk to. Yeah, I mad props to anyone who's an amazing screener writer. It's the thing that like I love research, I love doing research, I love synthesizing research, I love reporting it. Like the screener is like the part where I'm just like, oh, I don't want to do this. And in a sense, the panel was a response to that. Like investing a lot of money into the panel meant I didn't have to write as many screeners or as detailed screeners for a year because I had pre-screened a large pool of participants that made running research. It was like the best year. I ran so much research. I was so unblocked by recruitment. I would recommend any like I would tell anyone if you've got the upfront funds for it, being able to set one up just it clears so many roadblocks and accelerates how quickly you can deliver on research so much. Like my typical recruit used to be 2 to 3 weeks using the panel and our amazing vendor partner. It became like 2, 3 days. It was wild.
How do you refresh a panel? So you mentioned that a panel, it's like a hack, an anti not anti-screener, because you do pre-screen them, but it's like a hack to get out of screening people often. But how do you refresh the panel?
So what we would do is our so we sort of established that when we were working with our vendor partner, who I don't think it's reasonable or feasible for a researcher to manage a panel and do research. Like managing a panel is in itself its kind of own job because you need to refresh it, and then there's times where you're not using it, but you need to send out communications to kind of keep the panel warm and alive. So we would ref we refreshed, I believe it was quarterly. And then once we kind of hit, once we got to sort of a good number, it was about 200 participants, I believe. We were like, okay, we're done recruiting for the year. Now we're in the process, we're sort of currently in the process of renewing the panel for the next year. And so one of the things we're trying to figure out is, okay, are we like re sort of weeding out people who aren't responding to research requests on a monthly basis, on a bi-monthly, like what does that look like? I think what we've landed on is it's going to be like a quarterly refresh. So if you haven't responded to a study request in 3 months, like we're probably going to sort of boot you off the panel and bring in another participant. But and that doesn't necessarily mean have participated in, right? Because sometimes, requests are so niche, like you responded, but maybe you just weren't a fit. That's fine, right? Like we'll keep you on the panel because there might be another opportunity. And we know at least that you reply to the emails. That's sometimes half the battle of just getting, even with a panel, getting people to respond to participate.
The best products are built by listening to your customers. But without a great tool, capturing quality insights is nearly impossible. Dscout was built to solve this challenge. Whether you're running moderated or unmoderated research, the Dscout platform helps you recruit high-quality participants, manage unlimited concurrent studies, and share insights and video clips in minutes. Stop overpaying for questionable research. Instead, partner with Dscout, the company trusted by Spotify, Lululemon, Google, and more. Visit dscout.com for all the tools you need to boost your insights program. And how do you nurture the existing panelists? So we talked about refreshing the panels. How do you nurture the existing panelists?
What our vendor partner does is they send out sort of like a monthly newsletter or email, just sort of saying like, hey, like your friends at the research panel, I'm not super clear on what the comms are, but I know there's a sort of like monthly like poke of just saying like, you're still on this thing, don't forget you're on this thing. And every email, just because we also want to make sure that we're not harassing people, like a panelist just needs to say like, take me off, and they're off. No questions asked, right? You want to make sure that you're giving, if someone signs up and then is like, oh, this is like not for me, or I don't have time, you want to make sure to make it as easy as possible for them to opt out. So all our comms also includes like opt out withdrawal instructions so that folks who it might not be a fit for anymore, it's a frictionless way to get out.
Yeah, it's always a good option to give them a get out option. I know I've had, so I work as a contractor, so I work with different contracts. In the past, I've had a contract where I was doing research for an organization and they had a list of people. They didn't call it a panel, but they had a list of people who opted into research. And I had to ask, okay, are we sure? When was the last time we updated this? Because they may have opted in January, but if it's now November, maybe they're not interested. They said we don't really update if they're on the list or on the list. I'm like, that doesn't make sense because maybe they don't want to be on it anymore. So yes, being able to refresh it is important. But like you said, I think quarterly is a good cadence because you're not annoying them too much. But you're just making sure that they still are interested because they may not be they may be interested at first and then life happens and they may not be interested in a few more months. That's a good idea.
I think as well, in the era of, so for example, like that's also a little, if you have panelists in Europe, like you need to be GDPR compliant, and that's a whole other podcast, and I don't want to poke that beast, but you need to like, and I believe California is working on some privacy legislation as well, so you need to make opt out a very easy process, and so it's best just to bake it in now because legislation is heading all around the world. Legislation is heading towards a sort of more stringent enforcement policy. So like you don't want to be caught on the back foot. Oh, we need to f now find a way to sort of like solicit, or like re-up consent. As long as if you have an opt out option in any comms you send out, that's a really great way of just staying on top of that whole process.
I've worked at companies where they were trying to become more GDPR compliant, and it was just kind of a shit show a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I was living in Europe at the time it rolled out, and it was a bit of a shit show getting it rolled out. Although, in a sense, it just makes like you also want panelists who are interested, right? You want people who want to participate in research, particularly, with a niche population. Like recruiting is a grind. Like there is a reason why anytime I have budget to throw money at that problem, I will throw money at that problem and take it off my plate. And so anything you can do to make sure that the people you're reaching out to, one, are going to reply, and two, are actually interested in signing up and to do some research with you, like it's worth sort of investing, making sure that the tools you have to reach out to people have the infrastructure so that folks who are no longer interested or no longer in a position to participate for whatever reason opt out and open up that seat or open up that opportunity for someone else who may want to, share their story or share their experience with you.
That makes sense. And as we talk about having people opt out, having people opt in, refreshing the panel, how many people should be on the panel? I'm pretty sure it varies by company to company, of course, and project to project. But in your experience at Pinterest, how many people do you usually have on this research panel?
I think it does vary a lot because it also varies by population size. We started with a goal of 100. We hit that very, very quickly. And so our panel, as of the last time I checked, was about 220 people. And that's a pretty good size, because it's also expensive. Like at least we worked with a vendor who recruited each participant. And so there's a cost associated to having, at least for us, there was a cost associated to every single person on that panel. So we tried to, keep it at about 200 so that we wouldn't have, just repeat people every month, because at one point there was four of us running research every, once a month, using that panel. So I think it varies a lot. We found the magic number to be about 200 people for our purposes.
In-house, who has access to this panel? So, of course, you as the researcher would do product managers, business leaders, who has access to the panel?
Pinterest is very, very particular about access to PII and very, very strict about it. So the only people who have access to the panel data was the researchers on the content and curation team, and the research ops team had access, and that was it. Many a PM asked me to like deep dive in that data, and it was a hard no. You also just want to make sure that not, everyone and their cousin is like, oh, let me just go in there and I'll just reach out to these people myself, right? Like it there I learned something when I in a past life when I worked in student affairs at the university. Someone once said something to me that holds very true for user research as well. When you have a successful program, everyone wants in. Everyone wants to like tack on to that, right? Like they want. So what we found was like that was very true. People were very excited about the panel. Oh, could we like reach out to them for no. It was just the answer just had to be no, because it was a research panel. It was being used for a very specific thing. And I didn't want one, I was concerned for, privacy protection of just too many people having access to it. Legal had a lot of, red lines around who could access it. And I also just didn't want the panel to be overwhelmed with every random request from anyone at the company.
How do you teach your stakeholders about recruitment and about the process? Do you do like workshops? Are these just like one-off conversations? How do you teach them about the recruitment process for research?
I don't know if I've done a. I had really great stakeholders who like I just explained how the process works, and they also I think begun to under when the longer I was doing this, I was very lucky working with a team with a sort of long tenured team. So we got really used to each other. So my stakeholders understood like if I said it took 2 weeks, like that wasn't me lying or trying to be lazy. Like it could take 2 weeks. I don't know if I necessarily did anything in particular so much as just show them like how long it takes. Okay, like I would give them updates every time I talked to the recruiter or every time I did a recruit. Here are the challenges we're facing. Here's what we're finding. Sometimes it was like, oh, could we leverage like informal networks? And I was like, I'm happy to do that. Here are the costs and here are the benefits to that. If you have, research participants who are like your friends, like that comes with certain biases. If you have folks who are sort of already bought into the product, they're going to tell you, yeah, sometimes that's actually really great because it means they have a high level of product comprehension. And if you just need like a quick study to just validate some assumptions, that might work. That could come at another cost of like, then you're designing for like, the person who gets the product already. So in terms of like educating my stakeholders about recruitment, I think it was more of just a like, watch me and you'll learn what the process is. I don't know if I would necessarily recommend that approach. I think I would probably tell any user researcher, like educating people about how hard a recruit can be is, I think, a really key thing, particularly if you're doing any kind of niche recruiting. I don't think people always understand, no, I can't just snap my fingers and find you six Swahili speaking gluten-free bloggers. Like that's not realistic. I think easier on when you're just dealing with, even I think recruiting creators can be tricky, but it's not overly complex. It's more just a matter of like it's a numbers game. But for example, like my colleagues who deal with, research involving like advertisers who are decision makers with campaign budgets of over $100,000, like you're getting into like some pretty technical, some pretty complicated recruits, and it might take weeks to find these people. And so that's, I think, where it becomes very, very important to actually explain to your stakeholders, no, like it is like we need to find the right person and that will take time.
And lastly, so I know with Pinterest, you've been working with a vendor to help with like the panel management and running the panel. So my final question, if a researcher listening or just anyone at a company is considering hiring a panel vendor, how do they determine if that vendor is a good fit?
That is a very, so this is going to be of a bit of a long question answer because we actually interviewed like three or four, like we sent out some RFPs. We had a lot of conversations with people. We had conversations with some big players in the field thinking, yeah, we're going to go this route. And we ended up going with a small firm. Yeah, we went with a vendor who I had used just sort of on an ad hoc basis, but we had a really great working relationship. And I really like them. I feel like I had also put in the time, like they understood how I worked. I had educated them about who these creators, like who creators are. So they, because we had an existing working relationship, even though they weren't necessarily like the most sophisticated outfit out there, we understood each other. We got along really, really well, and I trusted their work. I wouldn't trust. I kind of really liked that I already knew this firm. I already had a working relationship with this firm, so I knew the caliber of their work, and that made me hand over a pretty significant chunk of money to them and say, like, I trust you to not, like, to make this painless for me. Inevitably, when you're hiring, when you're going external, I think particularly with something like a panel, there's so many moving pieces. You want someone who you feel confident will like handle the logistics. Like the whole point of a panel is to like uncomplicate your life, is to remove friction so that you can really just get down to the business of doing the research. So that's sort of what triggered my decision of going with the firm I went with. Additionally, one of the firms we were looking at was based in the UK. There was like a big time zone thing there that, so if a participant didn't show up to an interview, like reaching out to them, like there was a 5-hour time difference, so that could mean they won't see my emails or an urgent request or an issue pop up until the next day if I was running research in the afternoon my time. I'm based in Toronto. So I wanted someone on a similar time where I knew, like, if I needed to, like, phone someone or get a hold of someone, they'd be able to respond fairly quickly. That actually came in really handy because, you know, occasionally you have a no-show and so you're trying to make sure you're scheduling or reaching out to another panelist quickly. That was a big part of it. It really came down to, for me, do I trust these people for a year-long engagement with me? Because the contract we had for our panel was a year. So do I trust these people and do I want to work with these people for a year? And do I feel like once the contract's signed and, you know, they're going to continue to deliver the caliber of work they've been delivering so far? Yes, great. So yeah, it worked out really well, I think, for both of us, really. But it can be, it was interesting because it was a bit of a journey to find the right people for us, for setting up a panel.
The quality of the customer service from the vendor, very practically being in a comparable time zone, like you're in Toronto, you wouldn't want someone who's like too far ahead if there's a no show. And also, having a vendor that really understands the population that you're trying to recruit, especially if they're really specific and really targeted.
Yeah, and I think the subject matter expertise probably trumps everything, right? So I could make the other things work if someone was like, I am the premier recruiter of neurosurgeons in the world, right? Like, amazing, because then I don't have to teach you about all the intricacies I'm trying to manage. So subject, I would, if I had to stack rank it, it would be like subject matter expertise on like the population I'm recruiting for, probably comparable to also like quality of work. And then like the time zone thing, it wasn't a nice to have, but it was definitely like a lower order priority than the subject matter expertise.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I would imagine, like, for different companies, when they're picking vendors, they would rank what's important to them according to, they would have different priorities as to what factors were important to them. Like you mentioned, like for you, that subject matter or being able to recruit a super specific population, like use the example of the doctors, that would be more important in a situation where you needed that particular demographic. That
makes Correct. Sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think it was expensive. Like setting up a panel was expensive. It was labor. So there was a lot of upfront time where we had to get very crisp on like, who are we recruiting? How many studies are we running? Right. And sometimes in user research, I always say like, you know, the PMs plan the roadmap and God laughs because like that roadmap could change drastically. Right. And so like you kind of need, it was this weird tension of like, okay, how many studies do we think we're going to run this year? Okay, roughly this. Who do we want on this panel? Like what kind of creators are we looking for? So there's like this fine balance of planning with leaving room for ambiguity and for disruption that needs to happen. So there's kind of an upfront investment in time and money, but just like what it unlocked for myself and my team over the past year was phenomenal. Like just the speed at which we could move. I had never experienced anything like that in my like 6 years or 5-6 years of being a researcher in the applied space. It was truly a great return on investment, but it was an investment of time and money. Yeah,
definitely like that trade-off to make the research life easier.
Yeah, it was wild to me. I remember the first recruit from the panel, I was like, oh, this is like, we'll see how this goes, because you know, suddenly we weren't having to create an SOW and sign an SOW. You know, our panel vendor handled all the NDAs and handled all the comms and all the scheduling. They did everything. And so it just meant like all that admin that is usually part of my life and kicking off a research study was gone. And I got to just, okay, I told them who I needed. I told them when I was available. And 2 days later, my calendar was full and I was just running research. It was wild compared to what we were trying to deal with before.
It does make your life easier. I've worked on teams where I had to do the ops stuff, and I've worked on teams where I didn't. And when you don't, it's so nice. Like you said, you give them your availability, you give them the link that you're using, and you give them access to your calendar if they're doing that, and then they just schedule it for you. They track down the no-shows, they do the incentives, and you can just do your research and your synthesis and just worry about that. It takes a lot of pressure off of you.
Yeah, and I think this is why I think like ops and this I so often just I'm research ops's cheerleader for the reason of like I think researchers, particularly newer researchers, don't necessarily realize like when you're just getting started how much time of your job can actually just be admin. And so anything that can help lighten that load, even if you are still doing most of the tasks in-house, but just knowing that you're not going to spend 2 weeks waiting for a recruiter to find the people for you. And even if it halves that, so let's just say your panel takes a week to turn around, that's still a 50% reduction in recruitment time. That's incredible. Like that on its own, everything else aside, that's incredible.
Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, YZZI research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.